Hello and welcome to the Renaissance Foundation podcast, a podcast about inspiration made by young people. Renaissance Foundation is a youth charity that supports young people overcoming challenges to achieve their full potential. We specialise in helping young carers, hospital patients and at-risk school pupils. To find out more and how to support us, go to our website renaissance-foundation.com. I'm the media manager, Corey, and I'll be telling you about this week's very special episode. This is part one of our chat with the award-winning comedian, Dane Baptiste. We were having a mentoring session with Matiba, the Middle Temple Young Barristers Association, and Dane joined our session to have a chat and, most importantly, make us laugh. And we really needed it. In fact, it was so good that I decided to put out this episode in two parts so everyone can hear it. There was just too many funny stories and too much good advice to cut any of it out, so the second part will follow early next week. In this episode, you'll hear Dane talk about how he started in comedy, if anything is off limits when performing, and also is there a right time to tell a joke? That mixed with some great advice and stories that had us all cracking up. We had some technical issues, and there was a lot of us on the call, including staff, mentors, and young people, so you can literally hear my internet cutting out when I asked Dane questions, and that was such a pain, but I don't think I'm the only one with internet problems at the moment, so I'm sorry about that, but hopefully it's not too distracting. So yeah, I hope you liked this episode. Definitely stay tuned for more. As I said, the next part will follow next week. Please rate our podcast 5 stars, share it with everyone, and also watch more inspirational content on our YouTube channel, Renaissance Charity. Now I'll jump straight into the discussion. You'll hear our staff member, Rachel, introduce Dane.
Hello.
Hi, Dane, it's Rachel here from Renaissance.
Hi, Rachel. Sorry I'm late, everyone.
No, you're not late at all. You're actually early.
Cool. Hi, Sadiqa, what's happening?
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I'm not sure, can you guys see me?
No, we can't see you. We can see a logo of you.
This thing here, that's weird.
Yeah, if you...
Oh, there you go.
Hey.
Okay, hello everybody.
Hey. Oh, well, I'm just going to do like a quick intro for you.
Cool.
So yeah, I just want everyone to kind of give, well, we can't do a round of applause, but if we can, we would, so I'll do it. Like a massive round of applause for Dane.
I can see them and people are doing applause emojis, which means as much in this new digital world. Thank you, everybody.
Amazing. So he's kindly agreed to join this session to help inspire us during this time. Dane is an award-winning comedian who some of our young people have had the opportunity to meet at Audible. Before COVID-19, he was currently on tour with his new show called Chocolate Chip. And as some of you may know, he has a podcast which discussed actually some of the effects of coronavirus. So we'd just like to say a massive thank you for being here.
I guess the way we should do this then, because you're all looking at me like, so what is he going to do? Why don't you guys tell me about how you've been spending this lockdown so far and what's been good, what's not been so good, and then I can recommend what might be good rather than me being like, this might work for you, and you're like, it definitely won't. So does that make sense to everyone?
Mm-hmm.
Cool. And some of you who are just judging me, just continue to do so. I don't normally look like this. It's just a filter, which I, you know, so...
Hi, Dane. Is there a quick question?
Absolutely fine.
What it was is we've just been doing a session also about mentoring as well.
Mm-hmm.
And we've kindly got some of the young people from the charity who you met before at Audible and some of an organisation that is called Matiba, which is at the Middle Temple's Young Barristers Association. And some of the themes have been about helping people from different backgrounds to get into the barrister's sort of career. And I was just wondering if you had any advice. Have you ever been mentored or coached, or has there been any role models that have helped you? And also, I saw on your social media that you met Dave Chappelle recently. Was he ever a role model for you and stuff?
Yeah, so I'll try and answer those questions in reverse. So yeah, Dave Chappelle was definitely a role model for me. And I told him so, not as composed as this, but I am... He had a bit that he did many years ago on like the origin of the N-word, which I thought was really, really funny, especially because he kind of, I could kind of identify with the fact that he'd come from a very different background to a lot of his peers and was trying to find a more innovative way to interact with them, which I kind of had a very similar experience. So yeah, it was very inspiring and I told him that. But yeah, to be honest with you, I didn't really have a lot of mentors when I first started doing comedy, because I guess I found that what I was doing or what my intentions were, there hadn't really been a precedent. Because as I'm sure you're aware, there is not that much Black British representation in comedy, much less in general. And I even kind of addressed this in my last show that I was doing while I was on tour, where I was like, can you name any Black British person over 35 that you hear on TV speaking about anything other than sports, crime, knife crime, and sports and knife crime and racism? So we're normally given a very narrow spectrum of topics to discuss. And I was kind of like, you know, there's more to the lives of, you know, immigrants and the diaspora other than knife crime and, you know, raving. So I kind of just wanted to relate experience in a very different way. But yeah, there wasn't really a lot. So I kind of had to have a lot of reading and kind of doing a lot of research and kind of recognizing artistically that if I want to do something, it's got to be different to like my American counterparts and to what's been seen here before. Because most of the time when I'd bring up that question of who had gone before me, the response was always Lenny Henry. And I was like, Lenny Henry is the only Black British comedian you can name after like 30 plus years, then very clearly there is a problem. Yeah, as I continued, like when I went to Edinburgh in 2014, got nominated for Best Newcomer, and turns out the first Black British person to ever be nominated in their entire history. So that gives you an idea of just how little had gone before me. And so, yeah, it was very hard to find a mentor. But then as I kind of continued, I guess I had the privilege and pleasure of working with people I looked up to like 20 years prior, who like done The Real McCoy and people I'd seen at shows and stuff. And so, yeah. People would drop jewels here and there, so to speak, and I'd always be very helpful. And I think you can always have the opportunity for mentorship if you are receptive to learning from other people. Because I think when you start off doing comedy, we all kind of have an ego. We're like, well, I'm funny and I can let the world know. And you realize how many people have the same outlook as you. So it kind of humbles you and you have to learn to be a bit more patient. But I also just made it a point where when I had the opportunity to encounter people I looked up to, I would listen and take the opportunity for mentorship. So I do think it is very important, but I think it's also important for you to have a sense of kind of individual ambition and to always try and do something different. But a mentor, it's a job title, it's not necessarily a person. So, you know, for me, my parents have no idea what I do. They've never come to see a show, but, and I don't, that's not necessarily a bad thing because, you know, they did feed me and clothe me growing up and stuff. But yeah, they, my parents have been just effective mentors as anyone I've met in comedy, because, you know, the kind of tenets and principles they give me, where it's like, you know, being personable, being respectful to people in business, working hard, applying yourself. That's always going to be applicable in any kind of arena you're in, whether or not they're from the same industry as you. So yeah, you can get the opportunity for mentorship anywhere. But yeah, it was quite difficult at first because there wasn't really a lot. But then at the same time, it's more of a question, rather than me lament the fact that I didn't really have anyone to guide me, I'm now in a position whereby if people are on the same journey, now I can tell them my experience and they can learn from that and they can avoid the same pitfalls I've been through, or they can, you know, use the same methods to prosper like I did as well. So yeah, just because I didn't have one doesn't mean I can't be one. I hope that helps everybody.
That's great. Hi, Dane. I'm Emma. I am part of Matiba, the Young Middle Temple's Barrister Association, and I'm working with Michael and Sat and Rachel to get this project together. Thank you so much for speaking. I just wanted to ask you, what were the challenges that you faced getting into comedy? Because I can imagine it can be quite a tough crowd sometimes. What advice would you give in regards to that?
It's tough, first of all. So anyone who's interested in comedy, if you're in this to be famous or make money, I would advise you to do something else. This is... doesn't take off right away. Like, comedy is one of these things that's kind of up there with football and stripping, that like, as hard as it is to be really successful, you're having to put up there like, how, Dane, how? I'm gonna tell you how. Basically, because everyone can make a joke, everyone can kick a ball, and everyone can take off their clothes, so they don't really see it as being very difficult, so that people are a lot more willing to offer their opinion because they see it as being very easy. Because people look at sex work and things like football, so like, despite the fact that people have no experience, they'll always be like, well, comedy's not hard. I'm funny. I made people laugh at my friend's wedding. So that's the first thing you have to deal with. So yeah, speaking for comedy, the most difficult thing is when you tell people I'm a comedian, what they hear is I'm a joke. And so then they start volunteering their jokes and what they suggest would improve your career. And then, so you kind of have to get through that. Then it's, and then Doug said, because there are low barriers to entry, it can be a very saturated market. So the open mic is not only full of aspiring comedians, but it's just like, you know, people that are sociopaths that just want to talk on stage, high functioning alcoholics, recently divorced people, people that are just genuinely lonely. Like the intersectionality between, you know, mental health organizations and the comedy circuit is massive. Like there's a lot of people that you see comedy as basically a form of therapy. So that's tough. It's just having the patience to kind of work out, make your way through that and kind of recognizing yourself if you're doing it because you enjoy it or are you doing it because you just need people to hear what you have to say. So I guess that's the hard part, is just making yourself, distinguishing yourself from a bunch of other people that want to do something very similar. So when I first started doing comedy, I'd be like doing shows where there'd be like 20 people in the audience and 15 of those people were the other acts that were going to appear on the show. So yeah, that was quite tough. And yeah, just financially, it's very difficult because obviously it doesn't really pay particularly well. And the open mic comedy circuit takes place around, basically revolves around like clubs and pubs. So a lot of the time they're like, well, we can't really pay you, but we'll just pay you in alcohol. So becoming an alcoholic in comedy is also very easy to do. And, you know, a lot of the time you find yourself rewarding yourself because you're like, well, I don't have a job really. And I just got to pay £20 to go all the way to Derby. So I deserve this drink. So it's kind of avoiding the temptation that can come with interacting with other creative people who are equally depressed, but also have the same delusions of grandeur that you have. So it's kind of like you'll find a lot of like-minded people in comedy. So it's a big part of the discipline of avoiding just having to like use it to socialize and actually focus on what you want to do. Because I guess, yeah, we all have reasons why the world and situations can make us unhappy. And then you have to kind of bury, internalize that to go make other people laugh on stage. So that can have a long-term effect on your mental health, where it's like, you know, there may not have been a lot of joy in your life that week, but you have to go and give it to other people. So I guess you have to learn how to manage that part, the performative side of what you're doing. What else is hard? And I guess other than that, like, you know, it's like any other job. You have good days, you have bad days, days when you want to give up, days when you think you're the best. But yeah, I'd say the main thing is, one of the main problems is trying to make other people understand what you're doing. So, and the way to remedy that is that, you know, with any kind of artistic ambition or endeavor, is to do it for the love and nothing else. Don't do it because you think you can become famous. Don't do it because you think it will make you popular. And don't do it because you think you can meet different people, because, I mean, you can do all of that, but once that's done, then you'll find yourself feeling somewhat unfulfilled. So always have your love for something to drive whatever artistic endeavors you have. Does that make sense, everyone? No, you're still in the room, so okay, that's fine. Cool. Thank you very much, Emma. Next question, please. No one?
Yeah, I have one. Julian, hey. So I read that you were you worked in an office job before you started comedy, and then one day you just decided to do comedy. What was it when you were working that office job that made you think, like, I'm going to do something else? And what was, like, the final kind of, okay, I've been thinking about this for a while, now I'm going to go and do it?
Cool. I'm going to answer that. I'm just going to say, before I do, Ananya, I'm going to answer that question as well. I didn't get my chat up, everyone. Sorry. So after I answer this question, Julian, then we're going to just go through some of the questions that have been written down. Okay, cool. So what made me finally the job? It was a bit of office politics where I had a manager that wasn't very fond of me and was also very bad at hiding that sentiment. So it was just, I was just in a very tense, very cliquey environment, which I don't really like anyway. Even now in comedy, I don't really like cliquey behavior and stuff. And yeah, just in a nutshell, they were very slowly trying to screw me over, and I was being edged to, edged towards a cliff, and I decided to jump instead. And you'd be really surprised if you're in a job where you tell people I quit, how they react. Because even though you might see that in like American films like Jerry Maguire, it doesn't normally happen in real life and people don't know how to react. And I only tell you that story because I think a lot of the time we kind of internalize our angst, or we kind of repress ourselves for the sake of social convention, or we don't say certain things because we don't want to make any waves. And I think you'll find, especially when you see some of the more populist political movements of recent times, that sometimes just saying things to people's face and making them take it on the nose is more effective than you think. So when I was like this, I quit and I refused to give over power to my superiors, they had no idea how to react. So they were like, "Whoa, what did you say?" And my manager was like, "You could take that back." And I was like, "Nah, I don't want to take it back. I hate this job." So yeah, once you say no the first time, then you find it a lot easier to say no, and it's immensely beneficial further on in your career. But yeah, for me, I just got to the point whereby it wasn't just my workplace. It was like, I remember I was like, had this new job. I was like getting the new phone on contract, and I was going to get like a new car and financing the new car. And I just started asking myself a bunch of existential questions, because I was like getting to 30 and I was like, what is the point of buying another car and getting another car on finance? Because if you're driving to the same places, your life experience isn't really changing. So the question was, rather than what car am I buying, it's like, where is this car going to take me in life? And the same way that it was like, I can get a good job with a salary and a sales job when working like media sales, but it's like, what is the apex target I'm going to hit that's going to make me fulfilled or feel like I've achieved something? Because I don't know if anyone here works in an office, but you can ask yourself, like, have you ever walked through an office and seen a statue and everyone's been like, oh my God, who's that? It's Eugene. He was the best salesman ever. Once he hit 60 grand in a whole month and we never forget it. No one cares. When you're working in a system, if you achieve a target for somebody else, then essentially they're going to make you hit a larger target. In the same way that I was like, if I'm working for somebody else and I show a lot of potential within this line of work, so much so that my competence in my job makes everyone else's job easier, is that person going to promote me and give me the position I deserve, or are they going to keep me in the position I'm in because my job is making everyone else's job easier? And the answer for most human beings is going to be the latter, right? You're not going to promote people that are going to challenge your power. You're not going to promote people that make you look bad. So they're going to keep you in a certain position so you don't go anywhere. And I was like, that's not a system I want to be part of either. And then I started thinking to myself, like, you know, we all go and get qualifications and we all do training and we do assessment centers in order to make ourselves poised to be in a better position for more employment opportunities. But I'm sure everyone in here can tell you, whether you're of an immigrant extraction or you're a woman, you do not get the rewards you deserve just based on you being good at your job. It's not what you know, it's who you know. And I started asking myself again, is that a system I want to continue to feed into and, you know, perpetuate? And I was like, no, I don't want to do that either. And it was just a lot of questions I believe that most people ask themselves anyway, and then they kind of bury it for the sake of like, well, I know my job's shit, but I've got kids to take care of. I know my job's shit, but I've got to pay my rent. And I was like, well, in this particular point in time, while I understand that, like, I left work like 2011, and in 2008 was like when we had the credit crunch and the financial crisis. And for me, I was like, well, even if you are somebody that does go to work every day and you do adhere to all of your key performance indicators and you are working towards your promotion, all it will take is for a bunch of bankers that you don't even know to f*** up. Now you don't have a pension. So I'm like, well, then if that's the case, we've all built our castles on sand thinking if we go to work and we earn a crust, that at the end of our working life, we at least get entitled to a fixed income. And now you don't even get that necessarily. So I was like, well, then what's the point? Then why not take a risk? And I guess philosophically, I was like, well, this is a joke, really. So why not just do it for a living?
Thank
that was,
you.
That's how I got there, Julian. So I hope that helps.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah. Okay.
Cool. Right. Now, next question was, and Nanya is like, is there anything off limits in comedy? I don't think there's anything off limits in comedy, but at the same time, me being a comedian doesn't allow me to transcend my humanity and I guess what my social responsibility is. So in any other social situation, like, I wouldn't create a situation where I'd be making people around me uncomfortable by what I was saying. So I'm not necessarily going to do it just because I'm on stage. And if you choose to do something on stage, if you're going to say something that's going to be remarked as regarded as off color or offensive, then I'm also aware of the consequences of that. And I don't think that necessarily I have the privilege of not having to deal with certain consequences if I offend a particular group, especially if my offense is not rooted in fact. So I don't think there's anything off limits in comedy. There's a lot of stuff I don't necessarily find funny, but just because I don't find it funny doesn't mean that other people might not. But that being said, for example, if you're someone who wants to go on stage and you have to think about your reasons, so if you want to cause offense, like if you want to say something that's maybe Islamophobic or homophobic or racist, you have the right to say it. But as a human being, which is a part of a social species and a society, there may be consequences for what you say. If you offend certain people, they might want to punch you in the face when you come off stage. Or if you offend people, that interest group might want to make it difficult for you to perform because, you know, whether or not we like it, words are spells. And I think a lot of the time, I find what nowadays where detractors are saying stuff like, oh, freedom of speech, freedom of speech. Freedom of speech is a nice idea, but it's always kind of been an idea that we've never really had a society where you can say what you want. Because if you say something to a newspaper and it's not true, then you can be sued for libel. We have libel laws to protect people from telling lies in journalism. Or if, you know, you incite another group to be attacked, then that's called, you know, hate speech now. So you can go to prison for that as well. If you try and, you know, historically speak up against a theocracy and a you know, a system that's governed by religion, then you'd be in prison for heresy. So there's never really necessarily had freedom of speech. I think a lot of people, when they speak about freedom of speech, they talk about what they mean is freedom. They want to speech without consequence. And that's not really how the world works. So I don't think anything's off limits, but, you know, it's like you can take whatever shots you want, but, you know, be prepared to see what, you know, shots come back at you. So, yeah.
Thank you. That was a really nuanced answer.
No problem. All right. Now, AN79 to everyone. Where can you join the line from funny to rude? You can't really. It's all down to, it's all subjective and it's down to people's interpretation. There are some people that find, you know, just profanity alone to be offensive, so you can't necessarily swear. And some people might find certain slurs or referring sexual references to be offensive. And it just depends on the person, really. So, okay. Are you coming on? She flashed. Not that way. Just the square.
I think Ian's, he can't use his mic because he's in a busy room at the moment. So he's just typing because it's really loud. So he's just muting himself.
No problem. Yeah. But yeah, but you can, I guess you can draw the line from funny to rude where if you're going to, you know, like your parents are being rude now, they know you're working. Typical parents. So, but yeah, you draw the line where you choose, really. I think speaking from the perspective of comedy, the line for me is funny over rude. So you draw the line where if they're not laughing, then maybe you're just being rude. But your priority should always be being funny first, because if you're being funny and doing your job properly, it makes anything else you're saying a lot easier for your audience to digest or take on board. Yes, I hope that answers the question. All right, next question is, how have you been coping with not being able to perform and how do you create content? It's a very good question. It's been tough, but I guess I'm not doing too badly because prior to the lockdown, I was working very intensely on tour anyway. So I was all over the shop, all over the country. I mean, the only thing is, this time I was supposed to be in Australia continuing the tour. So yeah, that's been a bit tough, I suppose. But do you know what? To be honest with you, as an observational comedian, I can see that everybody has it hard. So really, it's not like, oh my God, I can't say funny things on stage at the moment. Like, you know, people are losing family members. People aren't able to work. You're not even allowed to, like, you know, we can't even have public gathering right now. So for me right now, I am really able to allow my feelings or my angst to take a back seat because everyone else is going through it. This is not something I'm having to deal with individually. We are all having a shared experience. And when you are an artist, sometimes that kind of thing can be a lot more beneficial to you. So I'm using this as a massive learning opportunity, you know, because a large part of my job is kind of looking at humanity from a sociological standpoint anyway. So kind of working out how our society changes or how global civilization changes, even by a very small measure over the next week or months is what I need to do to make me better at the job I want to do. So yeah, like any journalist now, it's just about chronicling what's happening and writing the material. And so far as creating content, I guess maybe I'm paranoid, but I've always been aware that, like, you know, the digital media and social media has always been growing, and we are always getting ever closer to, you know, previous media like radio and television, not necessarily becoming obsolete, but being diminished in terms of its influence. So I was already getting ready to, like, you know, have online content and engage people online. So for me, like, when I'd been performing, I like put together a lot of content that I can now upload. I'm fortunate to have like a pre-existing body of work with like previous TV appearances that can get reshown, sketches and a lot of material that I'm filmed as well. And then, yeah, and having the two podcasts. So I have an archive of podcasts, and again, through the miracle of technology, I can still do podcasts now. So that's still available. Shameless plug. You can listen to that. Still going. But yeah, you just have to find ways to innovate. So just a few ideas, and there's a few things I've been doing, whether it's appearing on podcasts, doing like impromptu shows, and yeah, I think a lot of the shows again have revolved around how to manage the isolation and the lockdown. So there's opportunity there. So you just have to kind of be creative. It'll be hard to believe, but like we're having a very similar discussion when Facebook and MySpace came out, and some people were like, oh, MySpace, this just sounds boring, or Facebook, oh, it's not going to last. So you just have to, it's adaptation is just, I guess, a big part of the journey now. So next question, Corey.
Hey, you mentioned your podcast, and I just wanted to ask you a question about that, be quick.
Yeah, of course.
And also, thanks for making the time to us today. It was really nice meeting you at Audible in October. I appreciate you.
Oh, no problem, man. My absolute pleasure, man. And thank you for everybody still listening, even with overbearing parents in the background. It means a lot. So.
Basically, you in October, I started listening to your podcast, Dane Baptiste Questions Everything. That's your plug.
Thank you very much.
We've started now, and all the young people on the line are involved. Mm-hmm. I just want, have you got any tips on just sharing their opinion, being confident with sharing like what they think about things? Because we're good at sharing information, but I think these guys are, and then what they know is what we want to hear. So any confidence speaking on the podcast?
Yeah, I mean, the confidence comes from experience, guys. With any kind of public speaking or speaking within social situations, is that it's something that you have to do frequently. So if you find yourself working out your timing and when to interject and when do I offer my opinion and when do I kind of come in, like that's not a negative trait on your behalf. It's just something that comes with experience. Because within conversation, when you're around people that you know who you are and you engage with regularly, you already kind of have a rhythm of speech patterns, and you know which friend is going to be louder and when you have to hear that person speak, on which person you'll encourage to speak up within your own social circles. When you're doing it in kind of an artistic or professional capacity, it kind of changes. So for me, it's like when I first started doing panel shows, I didn't want to step on people's toes. I wouldn't necessarily say things, but then you find that you become a lot more obscured and then people don't necessarily hear your perspective. So it's just kind of learning to be assertive and not obnoxious and be like, if you hear something that resonates with you or something that you may have superior knowledge on, then it's just being able to interject there and having that kind of mutual agreement with everyone else that, you know, everyone knows that everyone contributes to this podcast effectively. So yeah, there's no real wrong way of kind of speaking, or, you know, it's a conversation. You're trying to emulate conversation. That's the appeal of podcasts, is that people are privy to conversations and privy to an exchange of information and knowledge that they wouldn't normally have. So yeah, just be confident in that fact that if people are listening, they are interested in what you have to say. And, you know, I'd say for yourself and for the sake of mental health, as I'm sure we're all aware, it's very rare that you get to be in a position where everyone's listening to what you have to say, or and people are taking on board what you're saying. So relish in that fact. And if you've got something to say, you know, I will try and be like, if by some reason I'm not able to say what I want, then I always use this opportunity to say how I actually feel. And don't feel you can't say things, or don't curb your speech or your outlook because you're afraid of how you'll be viewed by other people. Because, you know, with recording stuff or performance, like, you're giving an account of yourself, and you need to ask yourself, if someone hadn't met me and they had to use this to work out what kind of person I was, what would they think? So always use that. And yeah, and just never censor yourself. If you are genuinely sure what you're going to say is not going to cause any harm or loss to any other human being, then just go for it. So yeah, Corey, just be yourself, man. Say what you genuinely think and respect the space and opinion of others. And I think the more you do it, the more of a rhythm you'll develop. So it's just, yeah, experience and timing and honesty, just like with performing comedy.
Oh, thank you so much. That's really good. Like, we were really inspired. You gave us a good interview at Audible. So now we started. So we're just going to take it up.
No, that's amazing, Corey. For me, like, that's always the best indicator of success is more, you know, if you're able to set an example which people follow, then that's great. And yeah, so it's a symbiotic relationship. So, you know, if I can inspire people, and, you know, people are able to validate what I do by being like, you know, thanks. It's all good, man. We all need each other, especially at this time. Cameron's question was, how do you judge your audience to know when it's the right time to make certain jokes? Again, it's kind of from experience. You just learn once you're on stage, and you kind of learn in the same way that, I guess, if you're doing some kind of sports, and the more used you get to that environment, you become more experienced and have a bigger view of how that works. So if you play football, your vision improves and you have much broader vision. And it's the same thing with like a comedy show. At first, when you first start performing comedy on stage, you're like, I don't care who's there. I don't want the lights off. I just want everyone to think I'm funny. But once you get more comfortable with your stagecraft and your persona and your timing, then you might take time to look around and see what kind of people are in the audience and see who you're dealing with. So myself personally, like, there's been times where, and this is for all comedians, like, let's say you have a room with 100 people. If you're in a room with 100 people and 98 of them people are laughing and two people aren't, you will notice the two people that aren't laughing before you notice everybody else like doubling over at your jokes. So sometimes you might think, what am I saying? Why is that person not enjoying it? But there are times now when I may actually inquire as to why that person's not laughing and use that as a thread to like get into something else. But I kind of judge it by my material and then basically how my audience is reacting to my narrative. So there might be something I'll be talking about. So maybe I'm discussing Brexit and, you know, I might be performing to a room of like people that voted to leave. And so if I'm talking from a perspective of wanting to remain, I'll be able to tell if they're becoming uncomfortable or they're becoming quite tense. So then really it's a question of, do I want to continue with my thread and maybe antagonize my audience, or do I want to maybe move away from this in order to bring them back on side? And again, that's really just down to my mood and just principle at the time. There's some things you might say that offend certain people, but sometimes I might want to offend them because that's what I'm talking about. So, you know, if they're offended by it, I'm like, good, because the truth hurts and I'm talking about you. So, yeah, you basically judge on, I guess it's like any other kind of situation or performance you'd be in. You judge by, you know, all the other external stimulus. You can judge by the temperature in the room, the timing, the time of day, the kind of people in the audience, like, you know, based on the, you know, the general age. So I guess people, you can kind of make superficial judgments based on what you see, but you'll never really know what kind of audience you're dealing with until you start performing. So I hope that helps. All right, hold on. Let's keep scrolling.
It does, thank you.
Okay, cool. Amazing. Okay, this next question is from Wafa Atab, and it's, do you plan your jokes or do you just say what you know? And the answer, Wafa, is a mixture of both. My advice to anyone that maybe wants to do comedy is that think of it like music, where when you first start off as a recording artist and you're doing PAs, you perform like your single, like your radio single. This is what you want people to know you for. You want people to kind of get into it. And that's how you're raising your profile. So in the same way with comedy, you have your 5-minute set, and the 5-minute set is what you use for people to know who you are, how you see the world, and hopefully what distinguishes you from all of your other comics, and which is very hard to do in 5 minutes. But once you learn, then that's probably the one of the hardest leaps you make from being a novice to being somewhat of an experienced comedian. But yeah, for the most, so you have, and then after that, so you kind of stick to the script. And I guess as you become more comfortable on stage and more comfortable in your performance, then you'll have the experience of being able to how to react and perform off the cuff and ad lib stuff. But I, for the most part, I don't say, at first I would kind of have a set that I would plan. And then as I kind of started getting a bit more experience, I kind of have what I refer to as kind of like a skeletal plan. And I can like tack stuff on depending on how the audience reacts. Because yeah, up until I became a lot more experienced, I'd be like, the best thing for you to know how to do is you should be able to perform your set upside down in a shark tank with a safe on your head. And that's only because you need that grounding so that if someone does heckle you or throw you off or ask you questions or they laugh for too long, you're going to be able to return back to the same place and return to your script so you're not thrown. And then the more experience you gain, then you can kind of ad-lib. Or think about it, boxing, like you have very basic combinations and you have very basic footwork. Once you have the audience on side and you're more comfortable in the ring, then you can start like doing the fancy footwork and doing windmill punches and starting to showboat. So I say I do have an initial plan, but what I work on now is planning on how to react to that audience. Because I think once you learn that, it makes every performance experience unique and for that audience and for yourself as well. So I hope that helps, Wafa. Any more questions, please?
Dane, I have a question. Yeah. And I just wanted to set me up. I'm just on mute because it'd be distracting if I was laughing. But you told us a story of one time of about, or what I want to ask basically is about nerves, and how do you deal with nerves? And I remember you talking about turning up early, like really early to work.
Yeah.
So have you got any more stories like that?
of it. Oh, nerves. Oh, yeah. I just the little things all the time, man. There's been times when I've been so nervous for a gig or trying to get there on time, and I've gone out my car and went towards the venue, and I'm like, oh yeah, I left the keys in the ignition and the car door open, and I had to go back and do stuff like that. So I've been rushing in that respect. Yeah, and for those who don't know the story, so when I was in Edinburgh, like 2011, I got the opportunity to perform at the BBC. Now, this is basically means that the BBC have like a tent in Edinburgh, which is like a live stage, and they have just performances of different natures like every night throughout the festival. I didn't know at the time, so when they said BBC, obviously I'm like, well, this is going to be my first opportunity to maybe be on TV. So I basically lost it and was going crazy, and I was so excited that I couldn't sleep, and I was only doing like 10 minutes on stage, and they were like, so be here at 11, Dane, and then we'll get you ready. And so I turned up at 11 a.m. being like, hi, I'm Dane, I'm here to perform. And they was like, what? And I was like, I'm here to perform. It was like, yeah, that's at 11 p.m. So I was 12 hours early for the show because I was so nervous and excited that I probably didn't read the email properly. But yeah, and then I went back and slept, and it turned out fine anyway. And A, because it was a good gig, it went very well. And I was on with two other comics back in 2011. Who were very nice guys, and they were super supportive. And then afterwards, we had to go and schmooze and talk to the BBC execs about opportunities. Those two guys were Nick Kelm and Ramesh Ranganathan. So, no, it was interesting. But yeah, so in terms of nerves, I can tell you, you don't necessarily lose nerves. And I think it's important that you still have, it stirs emotion when you are going to perform or express yourself artistically, because it means you care about what you're doing. And, you know, it should still kind of provide that rush for you. What you just learn is to manage your nerves better. When I did have a certain level of mentorship when I started doing comedy, as a guy called Mr. C, and he would always be like, because I guess a lot of time when you watch comedy, you'll see someone stop and have a drink and kind of, like I said, kind of create this whole aesthetic of having a conversation that's very casual. I would say that I wouldn't advise drinking or doing anything before a show that you may end up relying on and you may associate with making you feel a lot more calm. Because I remember being quite superstitious, and I'd worry about like how my hair was cut when I had hair and what I was drinking before I went on stage or what I wore. And then as I went on, I was like, you shouldn't rely on any of those things, because if the situation occurs, you don't have access to those things. You don't want it to have a bearing on your performance. So again, there's a problem is with comedy. And I guess the good thing about it as well is that those competencies and those disciplines, you can only learn from performing it. So the more you do it, the more you get used to managing your nerves. Because like, for example, Corey, like I perform at festivals. I'm not using the toilet in a festival, Corey. I simply won't. I won't! So I hope that answers everyone's question.
I think that's a really wise choice, to be honest.
Listen, I went to Glastonbury about 4 years ago, and it rained more on that day than it rained ever since 1998. So, horror. The horror. Cool. So, next question is from Wafa. How long have you been telling jokes on stage? And was I funny when I was younger? So the answer to the first question is, this year, should I get back to a stage, will be 10 years of telling jokes on stage. I had a few goes back in 2006, so two or three, and when I was working, just to see what it was like. And then I kind of went back to work. Then I got the bug again. And then I said, I quit. Go yourselves. True story. And then, yeah, 2011, yeah, started. And then Rich brings us to here. And, yeah, when I was younger, people would say I was funny. But the weird thing was, I found most people found me funny when I was complaining about stuff. So I'd be talking about, like, maybe a crappy trip or, like, maybe something I ate that I didn't like. And people would laugh at it. Basically, I always found that people would laugh at me when I was complaining. And then when I first started doing comedy, I found it very difficult to write material because I was trying to write things I thought would make people laugh. And then when I started writing stuff that I felt was true or things that annoyed me, then I found it a lot more of an organic process and a lot easier to do. So I find now people are kind of like, oh, you have a real like deadpan kind of angry demeanor on stage. And it's because when I'm just being honest and just talking about that winds me up, yeah, that's what kind of makes people laugh. And I guess there's the rationale behind that is that if I'm talking about a shared experience that I find even mildly traumatic and people laugh, I guess it's the whole old saying that like, if you don't laugh, you'll cry. So it's cathartic for me to be like, this stuff me off. And then people are like, you know, it me off too. And then we all laugh about it, kind of diffuses the grenade. So it's, I guess I do it, and again, I do it because I feel that, especially given, you know, being a child of immigrants and having that experience, that a lot of the time, especially within British culture, we're taught very much to internalize any angst or any anger we may have about the world that we see. And, you know, I think we can all attest to the fact that internalizing your pain long term is just going to affect you. And this is why you have issues of mental health, because people are suffering in some form or another and don't really have an outlet for it. So for me, it's like, I talk about shit that pisses me off. And, you know, I've been told a lot of time, you could smile a lot more on stage, or you could be happy about stuff. And I'm like, well, go f*** yourself, innit? Try take a walk in my shoes and see how that feels. And then, I do it, like I said, in the same way with work and stuff, whereby I know most, the experience of most human beings, that they have to kind of suppress whatever they're dealing with for the sake of a social obligation. So I kind of like talk about stuff where it's like, if I could say what I wanted and not be worried about losing my job, or then what would I say? So that is a big part of my narrative and my editorial as a comic. I hope that answers the question, everybody. But yeah, my family, they all thought I was funny, and my friends thought I was funny, most of them, until I was like, and they still do. But I found most of my, so my close friends and family were cool with it. I found that most of my friends and acquaintances and stuff all thought I was quite funny until I said I was going to be a comedian. They were like, but you're funny, but you're not ha-ha funny. Because it was just very hard for people to see the transition from me telling jokes or quipping in, like, you know, a bar or in an office to making that into artistic performance. I mean, but I always had the plan on how I was going to do that anyway, because I guess I was always somebody that used comedy as my defense mechanism. So when I was in uncomfortable situations, or I met new people, or, you know, even in romantic situations, comedy has always been my go-to method of endearing myself to other people, or using it as an effective icebreaker. So it was just the same principle as taking jokes and, you know, because, and make, and, you know, that's the kind of person I am, is that rather than try and present myself as somebody, like, I want people to like me and stuff, it's like, I'll make a few jokes here and there. And depending on how people react to it, it helped me to work out what kind of people I was dealing with. So I guess it was just about a process of taking what I consider to be a natural part of my personality and making it into something that I could communicate to the world. So I hope that answers the question.
Thank you, Jane. Can I ask one more question? Thank you. That's really
you can ask more than one question if you want, Emma. You know,
okay. I'm greedy like that. And I totally get what you're saying about festival toilets. They can be horrific. But in regards to some of your performances, what's like the best audience participation that you've had, and like the funniest one?
It's a good. It varies, you know. Again, it's like, but I think I'll tell you two stories. So one of the funniest ones is I was a heckler. And I was doing a show in Bristol, and this like 14 strong stag do had come in. And sometimes what happens with like stag dudes and heckles and stuff, especially with stag dudes, and you've got like 14 men who are drunk and potentially coked up, all trying to prove who has the biggest balls. And the comedy club is perfect for that, because then it's like, well, I'm the funny one in the pub. Nah, I'm insecure if someone else is being funny on stage. I've got to prove I'm still funny. And I've got to prove I'm the coolest person on the stag do, because I need this, because I have nobody to go home to. So you have to deal with that mentality in comedy clubs a lot of the time. Unfortunately, what can happen is that if the comics and the MC can't handle it, then that group can end up taking the audience hostage. And that's kind of what happened at this gig. So this, or they were like intimidating the acts and kind of pissing off. And we were performing in a place called Prism. And Prism is not really a comedy club. It's more of a nightclub. So it's not really purpose built for dealing with that kind of thing. So it was always quite difficult for people. And then once the audience loses trust in this, in the night, and then they start becoming disrespectful as well. So like people were like starting to take drinks orders and ignoring the acts on the stage. So when I kind of came on, it was just about maintaining a sense of calm and control, because like, if you think about it, like in terms of like, if you're on a flight and the pilot's like, oh, hey everybody, I'm going to be flying the plane and we'll be flying this altitude and we'll be there in about 6-7 hours. So you relax and enjoy yourselves. Then you all feel confident that I know what I'm doing. Whereas if I'm like, all right, everyone, I don't do this very often, but please bear with me. We're going to be okay. Just don't distract me. And you're going to, I don't want to get on this flight because I don't trust this guy. So I'm going to leave. So that is the same thing. And so the heckling kind of continued. And rather than me kind of get angry and exasperated with the audience, I was like, let's find out what these guys are about. So the guy that was making the most noise, I was like, you know, so what is your whole thing? And he responded with, you know, some quasi-racist stuff that we don't need to repeat. It wasn't very good. And I was like, well, you seem to have quite the attitude. What is it about you that makes you so special? Because what you find is Heckling when you're surrounded by your friends in a dark nightclub is very easy to do because you have a support system behind you and the spotlight's not on you. Whereas if I say, who are you? Why do you think you're so funny? Give an account of yourself. Public speaking on that way is not as easy. So when I said to the guy, I was like, who are you? What makes you so special? He's like, I'll tell you who I am, mate. So he's like, turns around like this and on his back. So I don't even know how stag dudes work, but a lot of time people put like their nicknames and stuff on the back of like shirts. So his nickname was supposed to be Sperm Donor. Lovely. And he had written Sperm Donor as in kebab. So they printed that on the shirt. So in the space of doing a 360, he went from being the main guy in the room to the butt of the jokes in the room. Because I'm like, so you are a cum kebab? That's what you wrote on the back of your shirt? There's 14 of you. And between 14 of you, you lot couldn't spell Donner kebab, despite the fact 80% of you will probably be eating it at the end of the night. How embarrassing. So now the crowd are like, this guy that was intimidating us with his friends now is actually just an idiot. So they all start laughing at this guy. And then no heckler wants to hear from their own friends on a stag do, he's got you there, mate. Because then he got really angry. He's like, fucking hell. And once he starts losing control, now I have control again. And then they had to leave. And he's like, we're going to see you outside and blah, blah, blah. I was like, I'm not going to see you outside for any fucking donor sperm. I have enough. Thank you. And yeah. So yeah, that was a great night because it went from, you know, a crowd feeling very tense and feeling like they were being held prisoner because they paid to enjoy themselves and they're not in to enjoy their show because now there's a back and forth between this group and the act. So now that they're able to enjoy their night and now the tension's all gone, then we were able to land the plane. So that was very good. And then I'd say, even though there's loads of jobs that there's gigs and stuff I really enjoy, I guess you enjoy gigs for different reasons. So like, for example, doing Live at the Apollo is great because you're in like a prestigious venue, which represents a rite of passage as a stand-up comic. And then that's cool because like I did Live at the Apollo, it's like 4,000 people and everyone's listening to what you're saying and it's great and it's just going to be on TV. But then, you know, the next day I was in Bethnal Green doing a gig for 14 people. So there's always balance. But then I also enjoy doing new material nights as well because it's very fun, the process of taking a concept and making it something tangible and having people see your idea that you wrote earlier in the day become a tangible idea that people enjoy. Like, that's an amazing feeling as well. So to answer the question, Emma, like, for me personally, I can speak for myself, like, I find different gigs good for different reasons. Because sometimes it's good because someone's a d*** and you have to kind of put them in their place. Because the best part about it, And I'll also carry it like this as well. It's like example where I perform shows where it might be a corporate do. And again, when you have a do perform corporately, there might be a manager or a line manager and they're used to having power in a room. So when they see other people with power, that makes them feel insecure. So when you're wearing a suit and everyone listens to you and then the black dude in the tracksuit and a hoodie comes on stage and everyone's listening to them, some people get very insecure about that. So then they'll heckle and then I'll remind them, these might be your employees, but you're not my boss, so you can suck my dick. And I say that because I know at work on Monday, when they're in the work being like, I want these reports on my desk by 5 o'clock, everyone's like, yeah, but that comedian told you to suck his dick. You didn't say anything then, did you, Jerry? So I live for those, Emma. I live for those. Sorry for saying, anyone, you choose the genital of your choice.
Thanks, Dane. Thank you. Such an animated answer.
Okay, let's see. Any more questions?
Yeah, so I have a question, Dane.
Mm-hmm.
It goes back to something you were talking about earlier. Previously, you were talking about how when you turn up at shows, even if you're not feeling it on the insides, in you're feeling down, you've got to make other people smile. So mine is more, what happens if you had a bad show, it hasn't gone quite as you planned, mm-hmm. and you've got some negative feelings that you're taking back with you. How do you deal with them and not let them interfere with the next show?
I guess it's it's one of these things that's the real challenge in terms of artistic performance, is that it's not what you do when the show's going well. It's finding the resolve to return and get back on the horse when it goes badly. You know, I guess what they say is if you do martial arts, like if you box and you enter the ring and you're scared to get punched in the face, odds are you're going to get punched in the face. So every time it's like with your material, it's somewhat of a leap of faith, and you can be aware that it's not going to go down very well. And I think sometimes it's just a question of balance, Cameron. Like sometimes I can have a streak where I'm like the last 25 gigs have gone really well, and I can have one bad gig and it just brings it all crashing down. But you need those. Sometimes you need those because for a gig to go badly, then you get perspective again And, you know, it renews your resilience. You want to go up and make people laugh again to make sure and kind of prove a point to yourself. And, you know, and also sometimes it's like, I guess it's like work. You sometimes, like everybody else, we're going through stuff. And then, but for the sake of our job or for the sake of our peers, we don't want to bring everybody else down. So you kind of, you'll just kind of internalize that temporarily. But at the same time, I would say, you know, comedy is tragedy plus timing. So at the time when I was in Bristol and that was all going on, I was, at the time I was thinking, why am I even performing here? Like the carpet is terrible. Like this is not even a gig. Like, I'm performing in the Wetherspoons pretty much. But now, once I reflect on it, like I'm laughing because the situation was fine in the end. So, yeah, I guess because you're making an observation about your life, if you do have a crap gig or you have a bad experience, then you kind of leave a breadth of time to reflect on that. And you can probably find some comedy in it anyway. Because, you know, most jokes are at other people's expense a lot of the time. So sometimes if you're the butt of that joke, that can be very effective for you as well. So, yeah, that's how I'd say it. It can all potentially become material depending on how you choose to interpret it.
Thank you so much for listening to that episode. We hope you liked that as much as we did. Thank you, Dane, for the amazing interview and speaking so openly, candidly, and just being great, telling fun stories, making us laugh. We really needed that while we've been in lockdown. The second part is going to be coming next week, so please do keep an eye out for it. And if you like this episode, please rate it 5 stars, share it with as many people as you like or know. You might not even need to like them, just get it out there so everyone can hear it and laugh, because this makes a big difference to us, especially when we're new in this podcast and we've just started out. So yeah, just stay tuned for some more great content. Part 2 following next week. Head over to our YouTube channel, youtube.com/renaissancecharity, to see more inspirational content in the meantime. And also check out our website, renaissance-foundation.com, to see how to support us. Thank you.